Lake Marina.
Hi, my name is Tom. I'm an alcoholic. Tom M. from Lake Marina. First of all, I'd like to welcome the newcomers. If there's anybody whose heart that I can touch tonight, I hope it's a newcomer. I'd like to congratulate our token taker. I think it's Al. Is that his name? 28 years. Fantastic. We have an out-of-town visitor from Phoenix, I believe. Woo, Phoenix. If you don't know where Lake Marina is, it's out near Campo. Campo. I like to add an S and a T to that word and call it compost. It's an interesting little town up in the mountains, about 50 miles east. We live at 3,500 feet, and I'm a rancher. I'm retired. The speaker coordinator, can we pull this a little closer to me so I can stand up? You can hear me fine? Okay. The speaker coordinator, Larry, he knows me because I used to sit on the board out there. When I moved out to Campo in 2005, I was on the Harlan House board, and I had to resign. They said, hey, we got a place for you. There's Bill back there. Anyway, so I ended up sitting on the board, and, that was great. I'd like to thank the people who invited me down here, Larry and Christina and whoever else is responsible for my participation in this meeting. And I have an interesting book that I brought with me many years ago. Oh, my sobriety date's January 19th, 1995. I was in the old Porter Hall step study for a couple of years, and somebody was handing out grapevines, and this is the grapevine that was dedicated to Bill Wilson when he died in January of 71. The February issue had already been printed, so they put him in March. And there's a little line in here that I'd like to start with. I have to get my glasses. When you stop to think about it, Alcoholics Anonymous is a society which is founded not so much upon success as upon failure. The only reason I know is that I once failed. I drank so much bathtub gin, I nearly died. The capitalization of that failure and of many others is the foundation upon which Alcoholics Anonymous is built. So spoke our co-founder, Bill Wilson. I love hearing Chapter 3 read. I am a bookie. These are my books. They've been with me for a long time, and I do read them. And I have some lines in there that I know. You know, I'm sorry to say, but I just know. It starts out with the foreword. We're 100 alcoholics who have seemingly recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. The purposes of this book is to show you precisely how we've done that. On my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous was a result of a DUI in March of 1992. And I was sentenced to go to AA meetings. And I went to my first AA meeting at the Mira Mesa Alano Club. And in those days, it was a garage with a couple old chairs in it, a couple old couches in there. And I walked into that meeting, and there was two people there. I suppose one person was a man who was leading the meeting, and the other person there was a lady. And she reeked of alcohol. I said, what am I doing here? So I got up and left. They weren't really checking signatures in those days, so I would sign my own court slips. But I couldn't get out of going to the educational classes because they took roll call there. And John Buzzard was one of the teachers there that talked about prodromal alcoholism or something like that. I have no idea what that is, but he's an interesting character. And I guess he recently retired from what I've heard. But I wasn't ready for you know, Alcoholics Anonymous yet. I hadn't reached my bottom. On September 26th, 1994, a couple of years later, it was a Monday. I was coming home from work, if you want to call it that. I had just gotten fired the month before from a guy, and I'll tell you a little story about that as this goes on. And the moving vans were in front of the house. My wife looked at me. She says, "You're an alcoholic. You need help. I'm not going to watch you die. Goodbye." She took the kids. She'd already moved everybody out of the house except for my son. The girls were already gone. The animals were already gone. She left the cat. And she got in the truck, and she went to Montana. She has a sister that lives up there. And, boy, was I pissed. Excuse my language. Everything was her fault. It wasn't about me. Don't you know who I am? There's nothing wrong with me. Needless to say, like probably the night before I was passed out on the floor, but whatever. So for the next 4 months, my alcoholism got really bad. I had already started drinking in the morning, and I remember my new employer telling me it would be a good idea if I didn't come to work in the morning after I'd been drinking. He could smell it on my breath. And I said, "What are you talking about?" You know. Anyway, the next 4 months was brutal. I essentially lost that job, and I just drank continuously, 24/7. And, you know, I'm not going to bore you with the details, but I'll tell you this. The last 3 days of my drinking, I guess it would be probably starting the 15th of January, 95, I was on the phone with my sister, who's visiting me, by the way, today. She came down from L.A. She's on her way to Texas. She sold her house, and she's moving to Texas. She has 27 years of sobriety. I did visit her a little bit around Christmas in 94. She took me to some meetings. I would hardly call not drinking for 24 hours in that state of mind sobriety. I just didn't drink, you know, because she wouldn't let me drink. But as soon as I got home, I drank. Anyway, I'm on the phone with either my neighbor or my sister. I don't know, and it's really not that important. But the next thing I do remember is I was on a gurney headed to the hospital. And I went to Paradise Valley Hospital. And, you know, I remember the lady checking me and asked me to sign a piece of paper. And I couldn't sign anything. I was shaking so bad. I made an X on the paper. The doctor cleaned me up, and I snuck out of the hospital a couple hours later in a rainstorm. I don't know how I got home, but I took a cab. I don't know how I paid the guy, but evidently I did. 3 days later, it's very similar. Again, I'm on the phone with my sister or my neighbor, and here come the paramedics again. And the response was, "Oh, no, not you again." They took me to Grossmont for the same problem, alcoholic poisoning. And again, I don't even know how I got home that night. I have no idea. But I walked into the Lemon Grove Alano Club on January 19th, 1995. And I was so bad off that I ended up having to call central office. And they sent two Eskimos. They picked me up and they drove me over there because I couldn't drive. By the way, the car that I was left with was a 1976 Buick Electra that we paid $600 for, and that's the car that I got to drive around. Anyway, great 12-step car. Anyway, I walked in that club, and there's a gentleman named Marshall Hall who has passed away. And he looked at me, and he says, "I didn't know you were one of us. You look like S-H-I-T. And he laughed at me. And I was in a daze. I didn't know what to do, but I just sat down and I, you know, And I listened, I guess. I really don't, not a whole lot of things are really that clear on that particular day. But I do remember I was trying to, you know, be around some people who were members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I met another gentleman named Frank Lauer, who has also passed away, who ended up being my first sponsor. And they arranged for me to come over to their house. Now, January 19th, 1995 was a Thursday. I looked it up in the computer to find out what day it was. Anyway, and they took me home to their house. And his wife, Marilyn, who I just gave a 36-year token to last week, fed me spaghetti, put me in the back bedroom, and they took me down to the Volunteers of America, which is 1111 Island Street, the next day, Friday. And I spent 3 days in there, and I walked out on Monday. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, all right? I mean, it was over with. And I knew it, but I didn't know what to do. While I was in the VOA, I happened to be reading the Big, Big Book. I happened to be reading Psalm 13. And it says, how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long, O Lord, must you hide your face from me forever? How long, O Lord, must I wrestle with my thoughts and have sorrow in my heart forever? How long, O Lord, will my enemy triumph over me forever? When I read that line, the enemy triumphing over me, I realized that the enemy wasn't the alcohol, it was me. I am bodily and mentally different than my fellows. And I've learned a little bit, a lot about the disease, and I buy into the allergy deal. And I was told to get a dictionary and start looking up words, especially when I saw that word vicissitude in the fourth chapter of We the Agnostics. I know what it means. If you want to know what it means, look it up. Anyway. Allergy. An abnormal reaction. Big Book Sam used to say, when I was enjoying my alcohol, or when I was enjoying my drinking, I wasn't controlling it. When I was controlling it, I wasn't enjoying it. You know, I drank because I liked the effect produced by alcohol. Conviviality is a word. It's a great word. Anyway. And then I wanted the effect produced by alcohol. Then I had to have it. I couldn't live without it. And, you know, I'm in the grips of an insidious disease over any period of time. It gets worse, never better. And for me to drink is to die. Anyway, this allergy thing and this VOA thing, after I read that, you know, that line, that Psalm 13, there was a gentleman in the room with me, and he says, are you okay? I said, you got to read this. You got to read this. He says, you're glowing. I said, you got to read this. I had had what the book described as a spiritual awakening. My life changed that moment. Did my alcoholism go away? No. Did my desire to drink go away? No. But I had changed. And when I took my shower on Monday morning and at the VOA, It was such a weird sensation. I liken it like Paul the Apostle talks about scales, you know, coming off of you. And I was kind of baptized, rinsed clean, whatever you want to call it. I don't have a really good weird word for it. But something happened to me. And I went back over to the Lemon Grove Alana Club. And actually, I went home first. And I'm really weird about my yard. I have 7.5 acres I have to take care of now. I only had a little front yard then. Anyway, I started pulling the weeds because I used to mow my grass all the time. There's a bunch of weeds in the grass. I started pulling the weeds out of the grass, and it was like pulling spears out of my heart, out of my body. It was such a weird sensation. But at noon, I went over to that noon meeting at the Grove, and I met Jewel Johnson, who's also passed away recently. And he told me, you better get busy. I'm a very active participant in my sobriety. My home group is noon to one El Cajon, Monday. My sponsor is a guy named Scotty H, who will come up with 50 years of sobriety in March. Whose original sponsor was Jim Burwell. When he moved here in 1960, early 60s, to San Diego for health reasons, who started AA in Philadelphia. He was the agnostic. If you read his story, he'll tell you that he was the one to make sure that God, as you understand him, was in the big book, you know. And there was only 60 people at the time. I was reading the story last night. It's kind of fascinating. Anyway, so Jewel said, you better get busy, and that's how I got involved with the Porter Hall steps. It's a structured step study. You have to do homework. If you don't do homework, you get left behind. And, you know, so I spent 2.5 years in that room. And I finally decided it was time for me to give up my chair to let somebody else have the opportunity that I had. But it says our stories disclose in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what we're like now, you know. I'm no different than you guys. I hit a bottom. I had a spiritual awakening. And now I needed to get into action. My wife, who was in Montana, allowed my son to come down and present me with a 6-month token. So we flew him down from Montana, and then he got to come back again when I got a year. He actually got to stay with me for 6 weeks. That was pretty cool. I have a picture of that. I can't remember the old guy's name that gave it to me, but, you know, I can see his face. He was a fixture at that meeting. Anyway, the guy that fired me eventually hired me back, but I'm going to jump to something here real quick. My wife said she was never coming home again. And, you know, after I'd been sober for a couple of years, it was time to talk. And in November of 1996, I flew to Montana, rented a U-Haul. We loaded her up and she came home. We've now been married for 26 years, 3 kids and 4 grandkids. But anyway, the funny part about that is when we were getting ready to pack or to leave after we'd packed, anybody been to Montana in November? It's cold. We got slammed with a blizzard and we couldn't get out of town. She lived in a little town called Glasgow, which is up near the Canadian border in North Dakota. Man, oh man, what a drive that was coming home. Anyway, we came home and she was still a little suspicious, so there was, you know, some distance that she would, you know, caution that she was exercising. But I made it very clear to her when she came home, my sobriety and my relationship with God as I understand him is the most important thing in my life. And I'm sorry, but my family's number 3. And I don't know where my job is. It might be in the top 10. 12-stepping is more important than my job, you know? She didn't like that. Today, she completely understands it. Because without my sobriety, without my God, I wouldn't have a family. I wouldn't have a job. I wouldn't, you know, it doesn't mean anything. I'd probably be dead. So that was a great day, you know, and like I said, the guy that fired me in August of 94 hired me back in 2000 after I was working at another store up in Miramar. I sold commercial trucks for a living for 40 years, and everything from pickups to Peterbilts, and this guy wanted me back, and I went back to work for him, and I worked for him for 12 years. I retired in March of 2012. And I had done such a good job for the guy that he says, you know, I really don't want you to retire. And I said, well, I want to retire because I want Social Security, you know. I worked for a long time. It's time to have some, you know, some time with my family. He kept me on the payroll for 18 months. I wasn't going to work. He bought me a laptop. He gave me a phone. He says, I want you close by. And I just got my last paycheck from him in September of this year, And he paid me just enough that it didn't affect my Social Security, but he kept me on the, you know, the health care plan and all that stuff. It was pretty cool. Plus, I got a couple $100 when that was all paid for. The 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Frank Fahey said this. It's the second paragraph in the foreword of the 12 and 12. The 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, that if practiced as a way of life will expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to live a happily useful and whole life. And that word whole kind of strikes me, you know. When I was drinking, I wasn't a whole person. I was a half a person. And the 12 and 12 and the fourth step, it talks about twisted relationship with family, friends, and loved ones. We were never able to form a true partnership with any human being. I was never able to do that. You know, I was married, but, you know, I was too busy drinking. I was a half a human being, you know. And somebody once said, is one half a two or two halves? And that's a good question, you know. And you know, looking at it in a relationship point of view, if I'm a half a person, I give half myself away, I'm a nothing, you know. But if I'm a whole person and I give half myself away, and the two halves become one, and I still got my little bit of myself left. And that whole thing is real important. Anyway, you know, the powerlessness over my alcoholism and the unmanageability of my life is obvious. I drank. I could not control my drinking. I didn't care. I didn't need any reason to drink. I just drank. I enjoyed drinking, you know, and it just got progressively worse. And when I read the bottom of page 25 in the big book, there is a solution. It said I had two choices: going to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of an intolerable situation as best I could, or picking up the spiritual toolkit known as Alcoholics Anonymous. That said to me, do you want to live or die? I want to live. So I better do something. And, you know, I've already talked about the unmanageability, you know, getting fired, you know, three marriages, you know, whatever. You know, it doesn't need to go anywhere. When I got sober, I owed the bank, I didn't owe the bank, I owed credit cards $40,000. The bank wanted the house. I was unemployable. I didn't have any money to do anything. I was borrowing money to buy gas and food, you know. And it was crazy. It was nuts. So now what do? I come to believe that a power greater than myself will restore me to sanity. There's an old guy who passed away. His name's Father Bill Wilson. He's an alcoholic, but he's been gone for a few years. He has three PhDs, and I've heard him at a speaker meeting, at the old Saturday night speaker meeting, a long time ago. He tells a great story, a little Irish guy. And he says chapter 4 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the most incredible thing he's ever read in his life. And I didn't have a problem with God. I'm Catholic, you know, but you know how the nuns are. Somebody was talking about nuns earlier, man. They used to whack my knuckles with their rulers. I wasn't real fond of nuns, but anyway. So I decided to read that. And, you know, and they talked about finding a power greater than yourself, which would just solve all your problems. He was there deep down inside you, but you had to search fearlessly for him. I said, wow, man, that's pretty trippy. Sanity is an interesting word. If you look at the 10th step promises, it says, you know, we quit fighting anything or anything for by now. Sanity will have returned. We'll seldom be interested in liquor. You know, if tempted, we recoil like a hand over a hot flame, so on and so forth. Gosh, it takes that long to get sanity restored? Holy Toledo. Anyway, I came to believe in that power greater than myself. And I turned my will and my life, my heart, my body, my mind, my soul, and my spirit over to that power. And I do it every day, on my knees. God as I understand him. Whether it's the great outdoors, a group of drunks, good orderly direction, God of nature, the great outdoors, like I said, or how about a grand old deity, you know, whatever it is to you. I have a God that loves me, that cares for me, and doesn't want me to get drunk. It says on page 133, we're absolutely convinced that God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And for the most part, I am. You know, I got problems. We all got problems. Not a big deal. When I got to my fourth step, this is kind of interesting. I used to do a lot of driving in my job, and I'd sit in the trucks, and I'd have a little handheld tape recorder that I still have. And if something came to my mind, I would rattle it off so I could put it on paper, because it says we put it on paper, and we got resentments and fears and sex. I spent 4.5 months on that deal. I still have it. My wife and my sister were going to come here tonight, and I said, you guys don't need to come here tonight. You've heard my story. You know what it is. So anyway. And I shared that story, and I was fearless and thorough, and I shared that story with two Catholic priests. One of them I did twice, the other one I did once. The first one was a Saturday. It was an all-day deal of about 6 hours, and I said, well, he says, he looks at his watch, he says, I got to go say Mass. Well, I said, well, what about confession, you know? He says, you're done, come on. I said, well, that's good. You know, and there's a great line in the big book, in the fourth step. It says, suppose we fall short of our chosen ideal. Does this mean we're going to drink again? Not necessarily. It says, depends on your motives. If you continue to act like a jerk, you probably are. If you don't, and you try to do the right thing, you probably won't. We believe we have been forgiven, is what it says. I was forgiven. I was forgiven. And it's amazing, you know. I went to the other priest and talked to him about it too, and Father Justin, he's a pretty cool guy. The first one was Father Mark. They're both pretty cool guys. And then I talked to my sponsor, and he just got, you know, the parts of the story that weren't, you know, too weird. Let's put it, you know, as far as that goes. And then we get to steps 6 and 7. I get a kick out of these. The book's only got two paragraphs, you know, and it's got the little seven-step prayer. And I kind of make a joke out of this because I believe the writers of the book were smart enough to realize they couldn't list all the character defects and shortcomings of the human race. So they just said, you figure them out yourself. And, you know, when you're going back in the fourth step, and we just read the sixth step on Tuesday, the step study, it brings back up those seven deadly sins again: pride, anger, greed, lust, envy, sloth, and gluttony. And, you know, the great thing that I like when I read how it works is it says, don't be discouraged. Don't give up. Just believe, you know. Fake it till you make it. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. And that's it. You know, we're growing up like Dana was talking about. There's another line. It says, although he is adult in years, his behavior was childish. When I walked into these rooms, I had the emotional maturity of a 13-year-old kid, because that's when I started drinking. I was stealing it out of my mother's cabinet, her liquor cabinet. My mother died of alcoholism about 20 years ago. No, maybe longer than that. Probably about 25 years ago. My father was a heavy drinker who died of congestive heart failure at the age of 92, but he did see me get 10 years of sobriety, and he was proud. My sister's in the program. I'm in the program. I have three siblings that are perfectly normal. They can drink like normal people, I guess. I don't know. And the argument is this genetic? You know, I don't know. I do know this, though. When I introduce alcohol into my system, it sets in motion a series of physiological, biological, and psychological events I can't control. And it creates this phenomenon, which means beyond human understanding, of craving. Obsession means a morbid craving, a death wish. You know? I'm going, whoa. Somebody once said my character defects and shortcomings are, he goes, let's keep this simple. Just like Bob told Bill when he was on a deathbed. Don't screw it up. Keep it simple. Character defects are the things I continue to do that I shouldn't be doing. Shortcomings are the things that I fall short of doing that I should be doing. My sponsor, Scotty, says, but if you look them up into the dictionary, they essentially mean the same thing. Because if I'm falling short of doing something I shouldn't be doing, it's a character defect because I'm not doing the things that I should be doing. You know, and vice versa. It's kind of funny. And it talks about it being a lifetime practice. But the one thing that the sixth step talks about, it constantly talks about allowing the grace of God to enter and expel the obsession. It mentions it a lot of times in the 12 and 12. And that's happened. Do I think about it? Sure. I watch a sporting event, or, you know, Jack Daniels, la da 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 da. I don't care. That's all right. I don't care. Let them drink. I made the list. It tells you it comes from the fourth step, primarily. The greatest amends that I made was to my stepmother, who was diagnosed with terminal cancer in December of 94. Now, this is the month before I sobered up. She looked at me and she goes, Tom, you can do this. Because I was trying to get some money. You know, I needed some money. You know, no, we're not giving you any money. You can do this. They already knew that my sister was in the program. They know what happens. Anyway, at 60 days of sobriety in March of 95, I checked with my sponsor because we didn't know how long she had to live. So I went up on a Saturday and I did my whole deal with her all day long. And it was pretty incredible, not only for her, but for me. Monday, she called the church and got right with God. And that was good. And then my sisters, my two other normal sisters called me and said, what'd you guys talk about? And I said, this isn't none of your business. If you want to find out what we talked about, talk to Diana. I'm not going to tell you anything. I got to go back on the Thursday before Mother's Day in 1995 and see her the day before she passed away. She passed away on Friday. And my father was there, and my father and I had a very rough relationship. And, you know, something happened. She stopped breathing, and I went outside, and he came outside. He was all shook up, and I looked at him, and I said, Dad, it's not about what you did to me. It's about what I did to you. And it was over with. It was that quick. And we had a great relationship, you know, until he passed away. You know, they talk about 10, 11, and 12 as being the maintenance steps. Continue to take personal inventory. When I'm wrong, admit it promptly. And I do that. I had a guy pass me. It's a 50-mile drive to get here. I got to come tailgating me on my truck. Comes around me. And, may the peace of God be with you always. Bless you. Bye-bye. I don't want anything to do with this. You know, I don't want anything to do with it. Just go away. And you know, prayer and meditation is kind of interesting. I was fortunate enough, right down the street here, back in early sobriety, there's an organization started, Contemplative Outreach of San Diego, COSD.org. Check it out. It's first sensory style prayer. It taught me how to meditate. And I can actually turn this thing off. It's pretty cool. And I can just sit and be still and not, you know, fiddle faddle. You know, it's really kind of cool. And I tell people, make up your own prayers. Write a letter to God. You know, and one of my prayers that I made of is, Father God, you who give so freely to those of us who love you and pray for your love, direction, and guidance, return so little for your gifts. And it seems like a simple thank you isn't enough, so I pray for you to know that I hold it so very close to my heart and all of your gifts are treasured in my soul and my spirit. Make a prayer up. You don't have to use any formal prayers. The best prayers, God help me. You know, that prayer that we said when we got in these rooms? And He did. You know, we're all doing 12-step work right now. It's carrying the message, trying to carry the message. You know, and that spiritual awakening is, it talks about it in the 12th step, you know, that it has no breadth, no width, no height. There's no limitation to spiritual growth and development. We can continue to grow and mature spiritually until the day we're dead. And I try to always ask, what is your will for me today? And basically, it's do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly in the grace of God. That's it, in a nutshell. I've been given a reprieve from alcoholism, contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. It says it in the book. And I'm forever grateful. I owe my life to this organization. I've been fortunate enough to been able to do a lot of 12-step work in my life. Some of the best meetings that I've done 12-step-wise are prior to 9/11. I was looking at my whole court thing, not my court thing, but you know the thing I had to fill out to get into the jails institutions back in 98. And we used to carry a message into George Bailey. There was four of us, the third Thursday of every month. And I did that for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And when 9/11 came along, everything got shut down. And they wouldn't allow anybody to go in there anymore. And then if you had to go in there again after they opened the doors back up, everybody had to get brand new background checks and all that. And that was the time that I decided, well, maybe it's time for somebody else to have the opportunity to do this kind of service work. You know, a lot of people sit on these boards, these recovery home boards, and they're there for years and years and years and years and years. I sat on the Heartland House board for 4 years. A guy that I sponsor is getting ready to take my place. He called me 2 days ago and he said, "What do you think?" I said, "Do it. It's a great experience." But I said, "Don't overstay your welcome." And when I sat on the Freedom Ranch board, I sat on that front 3 or 4 years, and you know, some things, issues came up in Campo, and I decided to step down, and let somebody else have the opportunity to do that, to fill that seat. You know, I like the way AA sets it up. We have rotating committees. You know, we got secretaries that take commitments for 6 months or a year or whatever it is. I think that's great. So more of us can participate instead of having a president running the show and a vice president. You know, we don't have that, and I think that's fantastic. It's really important because it gets you involved. My first commitment was a coffee commitment. I think I was sober 3 days. I'm making coffee, and this coffee pot was like, you know, this big. I had to get there an hour early just to make coffee so it was ready on time. That's important to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. There used to be a thing called a greeter. We were cleaning out ashtrays and coffee cups at Mira Mesa Lana Club. We used to have greeters at the doors that shook your hands when you walked in. I don't see that so much anymore. Some meetings have them, you know. Carrying the message, you know. I have my original sponsor's second edition of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in that book, there's a story called The Paradox and the Professor. And the four paradoxes are you got to give it away to keep it. You got to die to self, you know, to live. You got to get sick to get well. And you got to surrender to win. And none of that stuff makes any sense. But you know what? It's real. I used to listen to a lot of speaker tapes. As a matter of fact, all my speaker tapes are cassettes. I don't think they do those anymore, do they? I don't know. You know, the second half of the Serenity Prayer is kind of interesting. The wisdom to know the difference, living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as the pathway to peace, taking as he did the sinful world as it is and not how I would have it, trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will, that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next life. That's the rest of the Serenity Prayer. Anyway, this old tape that I got was a guy named Dooley Stearns who was up in Montana back in the 80s, and he was sponsored by a guy named Bob here in San Diego when he got sober in 1950. And there was this poem on the speaker tape, and I just love the poem. And I read it at the end of all of my deals. I've been told I have 2 minutes, so you're going to listen to it, and I'm going to be done. It's an anonymous poem. The only other person I've heard who is aware of this poem was a guy named Bob L. from Glendale that I heard him speak about 15 years ago. And he had this poem. It's anonymous. It says, "I dreamed one night I passed away and left this world behind and started down that lonesome trail some of my friends to find. I came to a signboard on the trail and the directions it did tell. Turn right to go to heaven, turn left to go to hell." Ooh. "Now, I hadn't been too good on earth, just a hopeless, boozing rake, and knew there at the crossroads the path I'd have to take. So I started up that rocky path that leads to Satan's place and shook my head within, not knowing what I'd have to face. Oh, Satan met me at the gate and said, "What's your name, my friend?" I said, "I'm just old sober Sam that's come to a sad, sad end." So he glanced over some old yellow files and said, "You've made a mistake, I fear. You're an alcoholic and you're not wanted here." He said, "I'm looking for my friends," and a smile stole over his face. "If your friends are alcoholics, they're in the other place." So I went back down the way I came till the crossroads I did see, turned right to heaven as happy as I could be. St. Peter said, "Come in, for you I have a berth. You're an alcoholic, and you've been through hell on earth." And I saw old Dave and Ken and Bill C. and a friend called Bell. And, brother, I was tickled because I thought sure they'd gone to hell. So, brothers, all take warning and learn something from my trip. You've got a place in heaven if you try hard not to slip. If someone tempts you with a drink and you're not feeling well, just tell him you're going to heaven and he can go to right on. Thank you so much. God bless you all.